I'm going to give a talk tonight on sensitivity of the heart, because it's been a theme for me for some time as I begin to practice, and as I see other people practicing around me, to reframe the waking up, the growth and awareness to how it is that this manifests in our life from a heart perspective. I was on the retreat this last week and was talking about the longest mile, the journey that most people don't take, and the road less traveled is the one from the mind, the foot in distance from the mind to the heart center. And we have pretty much locked our lives into a particular range in the top of our skull, and are, for many of us, are loath to come down into any kind of feeling of being sensitive. In fact, sensitivity has taken on somewhat of a negative term, especially since the 60s, when there was a male-masculine backlash to the word, which formed the men's movement, in which we felt we were giving away our masculinity. And so I think this talk uses the word sensitivity not in terms of giving away anything, but in terms of coming to our full human quality, human potential. And it's equally applicable to either gender. And I think, I mean, culturally we sort of work against sensitivity because there's such a heavy conditioning on sort of a rugged individualism and self-reliance and that sort of thing, which does work or can work against a heart that is open and pliable and affected with an A. Because what do we think happens when we are mentally quiet? As we reframe the problem, resting our attention on our breath, and then as it gets caught up in thought, we let go of the thought, release ourselves from the noise of the mind, and come back to the data, the sense data, as it's actually coming in from the world. And awareness, when it's not, doesn't have a thought stream interfering with it, comes flush up against that data. And any time we do that, we can expect that our senses are going to be more awake. And therein lies the growth towards sensitivity. At some point, and at some occasions after we practice, it's almost as if we've made our awareness wetter. There was an old commercial on TV about, it had a drop of water, and it showed this particular cleaning agent, and it took a drop of the cleaning agent to this dome of water, that just a drop was seen there, and it put a drop of the cleaning agent, and the water flowed out from its usual half hemicircle, and it said, this cleaning agent made water wetter. Well, practice makes awareness wetter. It spreads the awareness out to the nooks and crannies of which we have often been neglected, in which we've often neglected. Those areas of our psyche and of the world, and attention to the world, in which we begin to really hold and feel and sense in a different quality, with a different impact. Many of us have approached the practice thinking that it was, in some ways, a practice that would get us away from that kind of being affected. We feel, or can feel, that being affected is the problem, that I'm affected too much, that I need to pull back into some safe region in myself where I have some strength. away from the sense data into some role or position that allows me some distance to things. Well, that isn't the way this practice goes. It's not a safe area of the mind, although you will find those areas of the mind if you so wish. You'll find any area of the mind you so wish. You can hole up in for eons. But the way to freedom, the way is the way into life, the intimacy with life, and no way is it a retreating from. And it's very important to understand that from the start, because very subtly, if we think or wish for the for less interference, just in some place that allows me to be a little duller than I am now, we will seek that out in our practice, despite the words we might hear in a Dharma talk or the books we read. So we have to be very sensitive and very aware that this practice, if it's working, we should feel things. We should be affected. Almost as if you could feel a mosquito walking on your sock. That sort of sensitivity. And there are people, sometimes many people, who develop that kind of sensitivity of the practice, and to the point where you can actually almost intimate what the other person, what you see passing on the street or who comes into an interview or something. Awareness can be so refined that you pick up from that person before they say anything, the attitude they're carrying, the disposition they're feeling, any emotions that might be occurring, almost as if the awareness does not stay contained in oneself, but moves out to feel the same sort of intuitive quality in others. So sensitivity really means bearing the heart, or the undefended heart. The undefended heart. So we begin, as we practice, we begin to notice areas of ourselves to begin with that we have just been too crass, too rough to have noticed. We notice what emotions might be driving us, what intentions might be coming up. We begin to see or feel ourselves and our dispositions. We begin to see not always beautiful parts of ourselves, but those parts that have motivated and driven our actions for years, those parts of our selfishness, of our crudeness, of our delusion, where we're just missing things. And there can often be a reaction, especially early on in practice, where the seeing of that, the seeing of the less than glamorous side of ourselves, we can recoil in some kind of reactivity. We think, oh my God, this practice is just making me worse. It's not making us worse. We're just seeing what's always been there. And it hasn't been pretty. We just, up until this point, chose to ignore it. And now we can't do that anymore. The subtle judgments that intercede in listening. When you take a stance in the meditation, when we take a stance and we just receive what we hear, we haven't even been able to decipher the difference between what we hear and the perceptions and judgments that we put on top of what we hear. So we begin to pick that up. The competing motivations that most of us are under in each act we give, we can feel both the quality of the heart and then perhaps the resentment that quickly follows or even precedes that open response that we make. Someone calls us up and asks us for help, and this resentment comes up, and then we cover over that resentment with, oh, I should be compassionate in this moment, forgetting and pushing and sublimating and suppressing the resentment, and then somewhere along the line we find ourselves very angry at this person and not really understanding why, because we've lost contact with the subtle counter influences that are operating. We think we should just be going towards the compassionate side of life, the heart side, and forget the other thing. Arrest it. But awareness shows us everything. It shows us both sides of the equation. It just doesn't start and stop with the beautiful sides of ourselves, the sensitive, warm-hearted side that would like to help people. It's also the troubling, disturbed, selfish person that wants to hide out. So we see all of that. All of that is what it means to come into the light. And so, awareness, we put nothing between ourselves and the senses. When we come to awareness, we put nothing. We put no response, reactivity, or thought. And so the interface between ourselves and our senses, sight, smell, taste, touch, hearing, is just the raw data of the input. Now, awareness adds another dimension to that. If it were just the raw data, it might be more frightening than holistic. But in our willingness to let go of thought, a fullness comes in. What in Buddhism they call clear comprehension, what other traditions call the intelligence of the universe. So we hold and we know at the same time. There's a knowing, a deep, rich knowing, but that is not influenced by the thinking patterns of our mind. So when there's silence, when the mind is quiet, the senses are awake. And of course, it makes sense that as we wake up, our mind gets quieter, or at least less predominant influence on us, and so our senses are going to be more alive. We're going to be more attuned to things. We're going to be able to feel the textures and the quality of experience in a very refined way. And this is an indication that, in fact, we are growing into our heart. We are making the journey, that foot-long journey, and perhaps we've even just gone a centimeter. It doesn't matter. We begin waking up to the textures of life in a more rich and full way. Now, the first indication, the first reaction that we have is how much self-protection there is. We were on retreat and there were people there who had allergies. This one person in particular from California, he had terrible allergies in this Northwest, and he would start many of the sittings with a sneezing attack. So there we were, some 40 of us in the room, kind of cramped together, and this guy sneezing, kind of like random shotgun blasts throughout the hall. And myself, and I'm sure others, because they commented in interviews, were in a self-protected mode. They didn't, first of all, know whether he had some kind of disease that he was shooting out, or whether there was just an allergy. And even if it was an allergy, how come he didn't take his noisy sneezing outside? Why did he have to do that? Why not stay outside, get the sneezing over, and then come in? So there's that first wave of self-protection that we go through when there is not something that our heart, that our mind likes. Not our heart, but our mind. When there is some discordance in what the intention of the environment is and what actually happens. When there's a conflict there, the first expression is self-protection. Get him out of here. What's he doing in here? Go back to California. Okay? So then a sensitive heart, a growing heart, and may I say most of us in the room, would let that first wave pass. And then you feel the pain of the self-protection. That is where the sensitivity, after the, you don't, so we don't react. The first wave is that recoiling, that protection, defensive posture. Let that pass, let that wave pass, and then there's the pain of how we're holding ourselves. The pain of cutting that person off, of not considering them, of taking them out of the heart. And as we soften to that pain, as we allow that pain to be there and you feel what we've done, usually we just only know that first reaction and then we cut ourselves off and then we're off and on our way and everything is fine. We don't have the problem anymore. But when you're in a room and you're sitting for 45 minutes, you've got to do something. So you let that first wave go and then you just let that heart get warm. And soon the warmth, you can feel it journey down. You can feel the self-protection and then the softening and then the inclusion. Because once it reaches that state and where the heart has been informed and the problem isn't so dramatically felt, then there is inclusion. And the inclusion is where you actually consider what the other person must be feeling having to go through a sneezing attack, not intentional sneezing attack, in the room there, and how difficult that must be, and all the other things. And so then the whole process is in that simple foot journey where the heart now becomes liquid. It becomes affected by it rather than closing itself off, you see? Closing itself off is just that immediate turning away from the world, which is the response that we have learned to make to things we don't like. But then if we just soften, just hold that response, feeling the pain, letting it soften, then the world comes back in and we are back being affected by things. But the point was that the mind tried to keep us from being affected by it. The mind tried to hold it up here to keep it from sinking down here, because the last thing it wants is to be affected by the sneezing. It wants to cut the sneezing off. It wants to eliminate or at least contain the problem. Bottle it. Put it in. Put on the cap. But when we're affected by things, we can't turn away from the problem. The problem becomes our own. We not only have to deal with the problem, we have to open our hearts to the person who's having the problem. You see that? You see how sensitivity flows? It makes the heart malleable. It opens it. It's like becomes porous. And the mind's job is to keep it contained. Keep the problem contained. Keep it isolated. Like a contamination ward. Keep it isolated. And in that softening, when we feel that journey being made, often people speak about the grief they feel. As the heart actually warms to that other person, and then the grief of never having considered what that other person might be feeling, or just in general, what has contained the heart, bonded the heart, strapped it in. I picture these big beer kegs with these iron straps around them. That's kind of what we do to our heart. We just put these straps around them. And as the heart softens, the straps that bind it break. And what that means experientially is that we feel that breakage as pain, of grief, because it's been our denial of the grief that has kept it bound. And once we let that grief, once we let the heart soften and the binding break, then we feel the grief. And sometimes people spend a lot of their practice time just feeling grief and wondering, looking out, trying to isolate an object to justify that grief. Oh, it must have been, or maybe it's an old memory about. But really, it's just the warming of the heart. It's just coming into our center, coming into our being. It's somewhat analogous to the fact when you sit, many of us feel some of the tight, stressful areas of our back where we hold a lot of tension, begin to release that tension, and our back feels like it's on fire with pain. But it's the pain of the tension being released, not something that we're doing to our posture that's hurting us. Same way with the heart. And so the grief is often felt very dramatically in our meditation. Now there's a continuum of sensitivity in spiritual seekers, and I'd like just to talk about that continuum. Now the continuum I'll talk about the extremes, and then I'll talk about the center, the middle way. And we might, as I'm saying and talking about these extremes, see if you can identify yourself somewhere on that continuum. You may not be the extreme, but mostly we're on one edge or the other of it. And the first extreme is the person who's exceptionally guarded and has a layer of protection over his or her heart and unable to access any sensitivity at all. And they're kind of emotionally flatlined. People that are just so guarded, probably because they've been so hurt in their life, that they've had to create a facade of protection and isolate and ward off any feeling tone which they feel could be ruinous to their health and perhaps has been in the past. And therefore, they're so guarded against the feeling and emotionality of life that they reside only in this dimension. And such a person, when they come to practice, are as if they're closed both front and back. And what I mean by that, Heather Martin was teaching the retreat with me, and she was telling a story about when she was on retreat, and her teacher, who happened to be Yanai, who was coming here, and it's all kind of incestuous how this thing works. Yanai was her teacher, and Heather was getting off of retreat, and she felt very vulnerable. And she says, I don't know how I'm going to be able not to be hurt. I feel so vulnerable, and everything's going to affect me. And Yanai said, well, you're open in the front, but you also have to be open in the back. That is, what comes in has to go out. It's not good enough just to be open in the front. We have to be open in both the front and the back so that we hold nothing and everything flows through us. Well, a person who is extremely hurt is open neither in the front or in the back. They are protected and covered over. And therefore, they're not really interested in the moment because the moment references a vulnerability. And they're not, such a person is not so interested in really using the practice for anything but to escape their feelings. So they feel like they're on a journey, but they don't want to rest or arrive where that journey might take them. And may I say that the heart just can't open when it's on a journey. And we play this journey game in our practice, like we're going somewhere, we're going to do something with this practice, we're on our way to something in our meditation as a way to protect ourselves from really being affected. This is an affected meditation. This will affect us. This will show us the pain of our past and the present. We can't bulldoze our feelings. So the heart can't open if it's on a journey. So we have to arrive for the heart to open, because it's only when we have arrived that the senses are making contact. Get a sense of when we're on a journey going somewhere else, we're not interested in the moment, so the senses have no bearing, they are not open. But when we decide to arrive, then we arrive with the senses opening. That's what it means to arrive, is that our senses are awake to the moment as it's being expressed. Which means that we're going to have to be sensitive, because when the senses are awake, that is the definition of sensitivity. So our heart is going to be there at all times and in all places if we have arrived. And that's really the beauty of the practice. That's how it holds us. So we're just we're so afraid of the exposure of our pain. And yes, that's part of what it means to arrive, is that we arrive with our pain. We feel that pain. That's part of the sensitivity. It's part of the sense data. It's part of the opening. So the second extreme on this continuum is the person who's wide open and easily crumbles and falls apart. Their feelings just gush out. And that's a person that needs a little more boundaries. Or at least has the ability, or learning the ability, to be able to hold their emotions. Because when the emotions just gush out, it just means that everything is about me. It means every time anybody winces or frowns, it has something to do with me. And we have no way, we're so enmeshed through our feelings that we have no sense of reference for that. And so establishing boundaries, if this is our tendency, is a very important aspect of the practice. Even as we begin to understand the emptiness of boundaries, we have to establish them. Establishing boundaries and finding and understanding the impersonal qualities of those boundaries actually happen in tandem. It sounds contradictory, but that's in what you know. You get to know yourself better and what you can hold and your limitations, even as you begin to see the impersonal quality of your mind and heart. Even as you become less, you might say, of a designated, distinct person. So, to be able to feel, I can hold this feeling. And not to take things so personally. It's not all about every time somebody winces, what did I do wrong? You know, we know people like that, don't we? In which it all means something about me. And now we come to the middle, the fulcrum. And that's, of course, the Buddha's way, which is non-attached sensitivity. Now, when we were gushing out, the first one, when we were all protected, the front and back were both closed. In the gushing out, the front was open, but the back was definitely closed. Everything came in, but nothing could be released. Now, in non-attached sensitivity, the front and back are both open. So that everything is felt, everything is available, but it is not held on to or clung to as me or mine. And that way, it moves. The data moves through us. It's not collected or assumed in terms of a position or posture to life. And that's the way of the practice. The way of the practice is, yes, it does make us more sensitive. And for those of you who are afraid of that aspect of it, probably have more tendency or leanings to be either a self-protected, where I'm not going to be protected of it. I'm not going to have that happen to me. But if we move into it and we really begin to feel what it means to be affected, it means affectedness, sensitivity means alive. Alive. Where else is our aliveness going to come from except through our senses? Through our awareness of things as actually coming in at the level of the data, as they actually, what do we, where do we think we hide out in our aliveness? What do we think awareness is? It can't come from thinking. That's the dead spot. But the mind will continually come in with its white noise of thought to block the senses so that we won't be affected. And that's its job. The job of the mind is to ticker tape its thoughts across the plane of your consciousness so that your senses only go up to the thought and come back. And what the thought does, the story of me, the little me, all of my history, all of my self-images, all about me, the me, the me that's protected, the me that wants to, all of that chitter-chatter, me, I, me, and mine that we go through all day long. Blocks the senses from natural awakefulness. In fact, what they do to the senses is that they all personalize. It all has something to do, as it screens through the thought of me, all the senses have something to do with me. Oh, it's my perception, my smell, my taste. It all has me in there. And all of the likes and dislikes that are associated with the me. So when the white noise of thought meets the senses, it's the story of the me that comes out. I like this, I don't like that. It's the same situation I was in last week. I'll have nothing to do with that person. All of that is how the data, the senses, become distorted with this constant chattering mind. But when the senses are awake, really awake, then there isn't a lot of story of me. The story of the me is stilled. Is it quiet? And so the referencing of these data, of what this is all about, doesn't constantly have a central casted character that goes through. And so it opens up. When it's not filtering through a central character, it opens up. It's interesting that the thought, all the thought was to do was to protect the heart. It's afraid of the heart. It's desperately afraid of the heart. Because the heart represents vulnerability. It represents the open front. And the mind can't conceive of having the back open too. Can't conceive of that. Doesn't know how to let go of anything. Everything sticks in the mind. And so when it weighs and judges whether it's going to be vulnerable, it says, I can't handle that. I'm not doing that. Never with the thought that it could feel everything and just release it. So when there's a story going on, the chatter of me, there's no sensitivity. There's no sensitivity and no presence. That's what we lose. That's what we lose. Not a small thing we're losing. We're losing the vastness of everything. And we choose mostly to follow that disturbance rather than to open to the vulnerability. And we have to test it. It's as if we're so unsure that we'll do a little bit of testing. You know, we'll put our foot in and then we'll put our foot out. And we look for higher amplitude chatter because that gives me an assurance and a self-righteousness that I can really feel in place. So the higher the amplitude, the more I'm in place. We are never better defined than in our self-righteousness. And never less defined than when we feel for others empathetically. There you are. There's the heart. That's it. There's the journey right there. The story I like that many of you know, but I just want to tell it because it's such a tender story to me is the story of a 9-year-old girl that I worked with in hospice care. And her parents were getting a divorce even as she was dying due to her mother's decision. And her father was in a great deal of pain about this little child's death, of course, his daughter's death, but also the fact that they were divorcing as this was happening. And this little 9-year-old girl had cystic fibrosis, and she would crane her neck, you can see it, and she would breathe. And it seemed like she was putting her entire attention on her breath, because just to be able to breathe seemed to take every bit of energy she had. So she waved us all out of this room that we had gathered in, and I thought she was telling everybody that to get out of the room, that she was going to die and she wanted to die alone. So we were all out in the hall, and I was trying to prepare everybody. Well, she may not be alive when we go back in. She just may have decided that she wants to die. So then, in a little while, we knock on the door, and we still hear her, so we come walking in. And what she had done was she got up somehow, because she was pretty much bedbound, but somehow she got up to her table, took out a big piece of crayon, and made a big I love you poster for her father. And when her father and mother and I and other relatives came back in, she gave that poster to him. Now here's somebody who, 9 years old, focused on sustaining her life with every breath, and yet had the sensitivity of heart to know the pain of others that were right there. And I just use this as a compelling example, at least it is to me, of how the heart is ageless, first of all. The heart really is ageless. That journey from the mind to the heart can be made at any age. And sometimes children are far ahead because they haven't been so hurt. But also that the reference, even when we die, does not have to be only on me. And what a terrible thing this is. That for some hearts, there can be a bridge to other people's suffering, even in the midst of their own ending. A lesson in how to die. There are two qualities to sensitivity that are very important. The first is the ability to listen, to receive life, to be able to hold it without an immediate reactive pattern, just as we held the person who was sneezing in the meditation hall, and not to constantly judge and weigh what it is that's occurring, but just to meet it on its own terms. Whatever it says, opening to the truth, rather than to our trying to limit or individualize the truth so that it means something to me, about me. So that takes us into the second aspect of sensitivity. And that is our ability to hold the data, to hold what's arriving in the moment, without personalizing it, without constantly referencing ourselves with every aspect of it, but just be able to be quiet within the listening, through the listening, with the listening. And so it just brings us back to the heart. We can feel the journey. We can feel the softness. I can feel the heat in this room. Then it was cold, now it's hot. That can be a problem, or it can just be what it is. If it's just what it is, we can feel it spread out. Just for a moment, do that. Feel the temperature and say, oh, it's too hot, or that's where it's contained. That's where it's all up here. As soon as we relax with it, the front and back are open. It comes in and it doesn't stay. and you can feel the senses in their vitality and aliveness and their wholeness spread across the canvas of the moment. Rather than being fixated on the upper left-hand corner of the one square inch, which is usually how we hold the data, relaxing with it spreads this out over the canvas, the entire canvas of the event. And so we arrive through our sensitivity. We arrive through our caring. We arrive through being affected. We arrive through our vulnerability. That's the open front. And our willingness to release and see it as impersonal, which is the open back. And we arrive through our willingness to arrive, not through our need for self-protection. Can we sit for a minute or two?